Good morning, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are pleased to see you all, and we will start this morning's meeting with a volunteer giving the declaration and the announcements.
Good morning, friends. And welcome to the ULT in Philadelphia. We just want to give you a brief rundown of what we call the Declaration of the ULT. And it's a little document you should pick up at the book table or the usher's table when you come in, or certainly before you leave. It spells out the program here in Philadelphia, similar to the program you will find taking place in 28 other lodges located all over the world. The aim and purpose, of course, is listed on the back in what we call the declaration. And it states our policy, which is briefly devotion to the cause of theosophy. And please note, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization, this is strictly a voluntary group. And each one independently makes an effort to give out the three fundamental propositions of the philosophy of theosophy and tell you why it's necessary to do that. And also to actually put into practice, to the best of our ability, what is advised in the fundamentals. Now, the basis for union between us and all the other lodges is just that, the giving out these ideas, and anybody who wishes to volunteer, participate, is welcome to do so. There are no obligations, there are no dues, no officers, or anything. So the word independent devotion should stay on our mind while we're considering these ideas. I sure hope everybody can hear my voice this morning. Okay?
Microphone fell.
That's all right. As long as I speak loud enough and you can hear me, I'll scream it out. Please, we would like you, when you pick up this article, to read on the front the source. And it says, spread broadcast the teachings of theosophy. The names of the two founders on the front. For that purpose, our task this morning, January the 12th, is Behind Will Stands Desires. Now, these are not cryptic terms and cryptic topics. What is all that about? It's just exactly the reason why it's printed this way, to at least get your curiosity going. And this morning you have a volunteer and volunteers who will present the talk for this morning. All of our work here in this lodge, in the building and so forth, is carried out by voluntary contributions of money, time, and of course, enthusiasm. So we ask you to pay attention this morning to the topic, which is Behind Will Stands Desires. It'll begin, as you see, at 11. It'll be over at noontime. And on Wednesday nights, don't forget, we have a meeting here, and the doors open at 5:30 so that you can come in for a couple hours and go into the library, where you will find an extensive list of articles, books, and so forth. And in the book table, at very nominal prices, you will find other literature. Please examine these before the meeting starts and after the meeting. Are there any questions concerning? Thank you.
Well, as was just stated, on Sunday mornings, there is a general theme given to a particular month, as opposed to Wednesday nights during the winter when we're studying a series of articles from the Ocean of Theosophy. The month of January, we're dealing with the path of spiritual evolution, and certainly that's timely with the January sun cycle. Last week we thought about perfectibility. And this week, the old Kabbalistic term, behind will stands desire, is our focus. We'll have a brief talk and then ample time for questions and answers thereafter.
Well, when we consider the idea behind will stands desire, when we consider it in the light of this month's topic, spiritual evolution, then really the idea behind will stands desire indicates to us that there's a relationship between will and desire. You know, there's not one in front and one in back, and we try to materialize it that way. But there's a relationship between will and desire. And if we're talking about will and desire in the light of spiritual evolution, then we're talking about really what has to be the right use of will and pure desire, purified desires. Because without the right use of will and purified desires, our progress in spiritual evolution will at best be hindered. And when we talk about spiritual evolution, one ancient maxim comes to mind. We may all have heard of the idea of man know thyself. If we look in the teachings of theosophy, we find that spiritual knowledge, or self-knowledge, it's the same thing. And we're told that, you know, there are five statements, three of which are prerequisites to self-knowledge, and then there are two statements to back those prerequisites up that were given out in the theosophical literature just in the first years while HPB was around. As a matter of fact, she wrote about this. And the first prerequisite toward obtaining self-knowledge is that one has to admit to himself that he is ceaselessly deceived. And we have to, deceived by himself. And we have to be acutely aware of our own ignorance. Not ignorance as in we're not smart, but ignorance as in what is it about ourselves that we are ignoring? What is the real self within us, as in the spiritual truth of who we are, our true nature? We have to be continuously on guard and question everything about what we think and how we think and what our motive for thinking is. And this is the first prerequisite toward obtaining self-knowledge. The second is that we have to accept and have a deep, heartfelt conviction that we can obtain self-knowledge. We can come to know ourselves. It's not something that happens in the flash of a moment, but it's something that happens gradually over time. It's a process. It's not an event. And it's not given to us by somebody else with a blessing, but rather we have to work for it. In the Declaration, there's a term called a truer realization of the self, a truer. It doesn't say that we come to absolutely know the self in a moment, in a particular moment in time, but gradually as we apply principles of theosophy in our lives and live the life, we gradually come to a truer realization of ourself, which is to say, the simultaneous acceptance and recognition of the divinity of the self, which is who we are. And so this idea of self and self-knowledge is the third leg of a three-legged stool, those three legs being will, desire, and self-knowledge. The third prerequisite is that one has to have an indomitable determination to acquire it, because you're going to be distracted. So you have to maintain the effort. Now, the two statements after that, which are given, is that you can't learn self-knowledge by figuring it out. You don't read it in a book, and you don't look it up, and there's nothing logical about it. It is a spiritual awareness. It is a shift in consciousness, and it comes about by living as though you already are. And finally, not the last one, but living as though you already are And finally, the achievement of self-knowledge is greater than having command over the elements. It's greater than foreseeing the future. In other words, even on just the baby steps that we take through the weeks and months and the years as we study, because we are attracted to these ideas, as we come to gain a truer realization of the self, that is far more important than psychic stuff, trying to develop psychic abilities. That is for naught. So, use of, you know, self-knowledge and will is what is required to purify the desires. And a pure desire and self-knowledge is what is required to open the channel within us so that the universal force of will can operate unalloyed. So they all work together. So what is will? Well, will is the soul. We can say that will is universal force in nature. And in this, our plane of earth, it is the sole possession of man. It is the sole possession of man in that it is a spiritual force. It's also possessed by beings higher than man. But anything below man, the animal, the brute nature, or whatever, this is driven by desire. Desire is the motive factor of the animal life. Will is only found in the possession of man, and it is will that drives the evolution of the planet. Therefore, only through man can the planet continue to evolve as we use will correctly. So desire... desire in its widest application, in its universal sense, desire is indistinguishable from will in its universal sense. But as men, we cannot comprehend that. We cannot see or recognize that form of desire. Those beyond where we are can, but we don't. So here on this plane, when we talk about will and desire, we talk about them as opposing, almost as opposing forces. And those two forces are within the human being himself. Will is the product or the child of the God within. It is the offspring of the God within us. Desire is also within us, and it is the motivating animal lower force within us. Many of us, mankind at this stage of evolution, tend to live our lives and create our lives and our surroundings as a function of our desires rather than as a function of our spiritual will. Why is that? Because both will and desires are absolute creators. That is the statement. On this plane of consciousness, both will and desires are absolute creators. And as we said in self-knowledge, we have to be acutely aware of our ignorance, of what we ignore. But by default, we build our lives according to desire. By default, we do. Unless we consciously, deliberately, thoughtfully, mindfully build our lives rather than in the image of our desires, rather in the image of the divine. And this happens if and only if we are able to put our will over ourselves as the divine ruler within us. The spiritual will has to be the divine ruler within. So, and we were saying because desire tends to create blindly and will creates intelligently. And so as we grow in spiritual knowledge, sometimes we say, well, how do we know if the this drive within me is the spiritual or the desire nature. But one indication is if the desire, the aspiration, the higher desire, if it is steady and constant, then it's of the will. If it's always changing and fleeting, then it's of the lower desires. Because this will actually is, it also has its sevenfold nature. And will acts in our lives through the ideas that we carry. Will acts through the ideas that we carry, and we color our ideas with what? With our desires. That's not a bad thing, it's just a fact. Sometimes we color our thoughts with our lower desires, and we get the results of that. Sometimes we color our ideas with our aspirations, our higher desires to be able to serve more, become more, and be of greater help to humanity. Well, the greater the thought, the more force the will. The smaller the thought, or more selfish the thought, the less force that the will has. So to live, to be in effort to be a benefit to all that is to set up a universal channel within ourselves so that the universal force can operate through us. So that's our task, is to awaken and strengthen the will and our use of it by conquering our lower selves. And parallel to this is to purify our desires. So as we said earlier, knowledge and will are required to purify our desires. Our higher desires and knowledge of ourselves create the channel through which our will, universal will, can act. And not and desire and will, we have to desire spiritual knowledge before we can obtain it. So desire and will are requisite to obtaining spiritual knowledge. All three are the three legs of a three-legged stool. And I know we have only between 10 and 15 minutes. We have one more point. Can we make one more point? Okay. Playing into all of this is the idea of compassion. Compassion, it says, is the law of laws. And what we might find is compassion is not the law of laws as in it's a law, we have to follow it. Compassion is the law of laws as in it is. Compassion absolutely is, and compassion is our true nature. We say this because we're told in the teachings that our soul is the substance of our soul is our experiences through life and lives. Everything that is worthy of assimilating into our higher nature is the substance of our soul, our experiences. And if it's worthy of assimilating it into our higher nature, it becomes part and parcel to the accumulated wisdom of mankind, of the oversoul, of all the human family. Now, when we talk about compassion, unfortunately, if you look in the dictionary, today's dictionary, it says, oh, feeling sorry or pity or empathy for somebody else. That's not what compassion meant to HPB and Mr. Judge. If you pull out a dictionary from 1900, compassion has to do with suffering. Not suffering hanging on a cross, but suffering as in experiencing. The word suffer means to experience. So compassion is the law of laws. That word passion in HBB's days means to experience, to suffer, experience. And we experience everything that every one of us experiences. All of our experiences that are worthy of assimilating into our higher nature is experienced by everyone else. That is what compassion is. And so as we walk through the day and we find ourselves in these human forms, like we said, be acutely aware of our own ignorance. Because if we're ignoring the fact that we're all one and everything we say and do affects everybody else, then we probably say and do things that are different than they would be. But if we maintain in our hearts and heads that we know everything we say and do does affect the rest of the world, then we'll probably act and speak and think in a different way than if we really believe we're in our own cocoon, because we do, we are connected, and compassion is the connectivity of all of the human race, or what we call the oversoul or the self.
Thank you. So there we have it. A student's view on Behind Will Stands Desire. And I'm sure that there are many minds in the room with views on this subject matter. Yes?
There's a word we find called tanha, that desire for life. And it says that is what brings us back, that desire. So we all have that, I assume, that we all have this desire. No one's excluded from that. That includes everyone. So fundamentally, we would think that's what's driving all the lower kingdoms.
It's a very interesting statement. You know, the philosophy is based upon a fundamental premise that there is an abstract absolute without any conditions that we could imagine or contain in words or thoughts. And it is said that desire first arose in it, that absolute, and it would parallel the more personal thinking about the concept of tanha, that there is a personal thirst for life, and that kind of passion draws a soul back into incarnation. At the universal level, there is a compassion for life, and there is this desire first arising in it, at one with will in a certain way. And therefore, this thirst for life at the human level reflects a mindful, self-aware, self-creative process of thinking, of a free will use that creates a karmic tie, that creates the force behind the law of periodicity, creates on the basis of desire and will, and therefore in the particular, in the personal, expresses this notion of tanha, this return of thirst for life, to pick up the pieces literally and to get up, get moving, and to do it again better. Yeah.
Would it be consistent from a theosophical standpoint to say that will is kind of like the ray of light and the desire is the movie you put in front of it?
Ooh. Is will a ray of light and desire is the movie that you put in front of it? From the particular, from the personal, from the animal man point of side, probably so. But if you can come in on a Wednesday night and pick up the glossary in the reference library, that glossary talks about will as being the one and sole, S-O-L-E, principle of abstract eternal motion, the ensouling essence, will of that abstract eternal motion, and that it is the first of all powers. So that it's the first of all powers, and behind that is the force or the essence of desire. You know, from where we are now, where we appear to be in a tangible world, and we use time to designate one aspect of our being, and we use place to designate another. We spend a lot of time teaching little kids over, under, in and out, up and down. This is a different kind of an essence, because from the glossary we learn that will exists and therefore desire exists in the earliest emanations we can imagine from out of the absolute. The earliest emanations we can imagine, without putting words, without putting ideas, without containing it, even before differentiation of spirit and matter. Desire first arises in it, this force of spiritual ideation kicks in and things go. In our world, that universal force of will and desire exists, and as mind thinkers, we have the freedom to pop desire in front or bring that to the forefront or connect with it in a personal kind of a way. If we use the analogy of a hand, it's one hand. It's certainly most physical. But if we consider that will would be the palm, the force that can be brought to a situation, the other side of the hand behind the force of will would be the implications, the mechanisms, the functioning, the push, literally, of desire. It's all one, it's dual, and it comes to fruition in the perfection of 10 fingers that can move. So too with desire and will. There's no before, behind, after, etc. It's a oneness that takes on a duality when there is a mind, a self-reflective, self-aware entity to sense it, and then moves forward to impress through all of the planes of existence we can imagine, through all the functions of those planes we can imagine, and it colors all of life. Yeah.
Well, we were thinking as you were speaking, what about the other kingdoms? We seem to see a will of a weed coming up through cement that we just don't understand. How can that weed get that energy to come up through blocks of cement? And we were also thinking the plants knowing to yield towards the sun. Same thing with animals. And we don't know, probably to a certain extent, it's even in the mineral kingdom.
Well, the question of will in the lower kingdoms goes back to the earlier point about tanha. And in the human kingdom, not even in the Dhyani Chohan kingdom, but in the human kingdom, there's this free will and choice and self-determination. In the kingdoms below the humans, certainly the universal force of desire, the universal force of will, the universal spiritual aspect of ideation, of consciousness. We're stumbling over the English words trying to talk about something that's very immaterial, super material, if you will. In the animal, the vegetable, the mineral, we note the force of nature moving in harmony, in a kind of push to set up harmony again in an instinctual way. The plant really doesn't have a choice. We've seen trees growing up in rain gutters on top of houses. A seed landed where there was soil and other debris, and certainly the water was there. And the next thing you know, the natural impulse, that thirst for life, expresses itself in a very unusual spot. But that plant had no self-determination. I think I'll put my roots down here. This looks like a good place. That process is missing from it. The animal has certainly a thirst for life, an instinct to live, an instinct to survive, and some things that in the human kingdom we observe of behaviors among animals, we think, whoa, that's kind of rough. There's no ethics there. Well, there's no ethics there because there's no freedom of choice. There's no self-conscious entity to note this is my desire, the illusion of my desire, and therefore I will this other thing to happen. It's missing, yeah.
Well, in regards to companion animals, I mean, we see some incredible, almost like decision-making skills that companion animals have, and they definitely respond to their human caregivers, and sometimes in such a high manner that one thinks they must be thinking on a different level. So would the being involved with humans, then how does that affect their will and
desire? In the world of companion animals, we have a very unique circumstance. Where we are in evolution in this particular round, we know we observe animals in the wild, and where there is very, very little influence of human beings, we might even be able to capture on film natural behavior. So studying wolves in the wild with cameras that are hidden in crevices, etc. They know that wolves spend most of their time eating mice in the natural surround, following their own instinct to survive, their own will to live. That's basically what they're doing. The companion animal who is a dog, who is in residence in someone's home, who is not a working companion, not a herding animal, isn't using a natural instinct to do a particular task of defense or whatever. But the companion animal who comes into a home presided over by souls who are looking for a companion, and we can look around and see souls, human souls, who are turning canines into babies, baby carriages, clothing, the whole nine yards. Those souls in those animal forms are being impressed by the human thinker. So the vibrations being given out, the training given by that human mind, the interconnection, the closeness emotionally and in physical being between the two changes the nature of the expression of the animal. And in some ways limits what that animal can do in terms of natural instinct. And the other thing that's at play there is that the human thinker can imagine and project and impress and begin to interpret the behavior of the animal as though it were a human companion. And that twist of perception is in the human mind. It's not in the animal mind. Yeah.
Well, it seems that we cannot communicate with animals mentally because they do not have that ability. But we certainly can communicate with them mm-hmm. astrally. Mm-hmm. We all share that same matter, which is our feeling nature is caught up in that, and oftentimes, if we are compassionate, that also comes out to our feeling nature. So animals are aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go and like horses or dogs
yeah.
or whatever, they are aware of that astral energy that you are carrying around, whether you are angry, whether you are sad, whether you are grieving, or whether you
mm-hmm.
are just happy.
Mm-hmm. And so what we see in the animal kingdom is a degree of intelligence, that intelligence, that will, if you will, follows a particular line instinctually in nature to survive and to continue on in harmony with great nature. When the animal is, we call it domesticated, or turned into a companion, some of the natural degree of intelligence, the sensing, they can move around and they can sense and they can interact. There's certain animal forms that allow for more expression of astral sensing. Horses, in particular, do remarkable things for injured folks or handicapped folks. Certain kinds of helping animals in the dog and cat world are capable of doing certain things with human beings. They sense things. And we know we've got proof of that even in great nature. It is said when the Indonesian tsunami hit, the tourists in retrospect said, you know, it got really quiet. All of the small animals and the birds had taken off hours before. hours before the tsunami began. So there is definitely a natural communication, maybe thinking and ideation the way we do it, as the comment was made, is not the same, but there is a degree of expression of intelligence. It's just not as free and as inclusive and as self-aware as the degree allowed in the human state. Doesn't mean the potential's not there. It just means that the expression isn't possible. The talk this morning mentioned opening channels so that that natural force of will and desire can flow through, and that spiritual force, therefore, of wisdom beyond knowledge, intuition in the human kingdom, instinct in the animal kingdom, in our state, by self-devised and self-fulfilled methods, we fit ourselves. We open those channels, or we close them. Yeah.
Well, we were thinking of the automobile we got in this morning to get here, sitting at the curb. And we got in the automobile, and we had to choose. Now, once we decided and chose to come to the meeting this morning, we pressed our foot on the gas, the automobile started up, and working, and then released the brake, and that machine got us here. So it appears that there was a combination of will, that which energized that will, and the automobile did the rest on its own. So behind will stands desire, then we ourselves are a picture of that. Because if we exercise self-control of our desires, we can do things intelligently. And the idea is that if we don't want to do it, we just don't have the desire to do it, nothing will get done.
The comment that we exercise will and desire intelligently and therefore go into motion and get things done, and if we don't exercise them, nothing gets done, that's true at this plane of physical manifestation of activity. And imagine, if you can, a scenario in which an individual is injured or incapacitated by sudden disease, and the mind totally loses control of the physical body. Akin to those early moments when you're not quite in a dreaming state, but you're certainly not awake and functioning either. Those ethereal moments coming out of a nap or out of a deep sleep when there's consciousness, but there's not self-aware consciousness. What wakes you up? What is it in the incapacitated life where there's soul and existence waking up once again into a physical body and beginning to learn how to use it again? That ethereal awakening that happens automatically is like the universal desire and will that comes forth at the beginning of a manvantara. It comes forth every day as we wake up. We change states of consciousness, or on occasion when we're very, very quite ill. And that whole, the notion of a three-legged stool, where there's a thought, there's a degree of volition, which is a lower application of desire, and then there's will that kicks in so that there's a force of action that takes off. That's universal. and it happens periodically. There is still activity even when we can't measure it on this particular plane. So while we may get into a car and turn the key and get here and accomplish something in a community effect, we are accomplishing something certainly that we're perceiving right this moment. But all of the existence prior to getting into that car, all of that existence in the deep sleep state, all levels of consciousness are still governed by desire and will, by force. And it's when they come together in the human state that we then have mind that can turn a key, that can put it all together and use it. Yeah.
Well.
No, this one.
Well, you keep on saying the word, imagination.
Oh.
And when we come to these rooms, we the first thing we learn about are perfected beings. And we always keep that in mind because there are those beings that have perfected themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure we all have an image of one in our mind, in our imagination. And like Jesus, you know, we all wanted to be Jesus, but until we realized we have to sacrifice. And there's so much pain when we sacrifice. So do we have to accept that as the path that we must walk, that is going to be filled with pain and suffering? It's only our mind and imagination that determines whether we're sad or whether we're happy.
Ah, boy. Let me make sure that I got you right. Teachers, Jesus, and we'll add Buddha to that, talk about pain and suffering in that move toward spiritual perfectibility, or in just life itself, that there's pain and suffering. If we make an image and hold that image, we have colored our perception, we have interpreted our experience, and therefore we've contained it and made it something that is reality that could very well be an illusion. The process, if we're really thinking about it, if you think about the ethical process of spiritual evolution, we are asked to be as aware as possible, as open and as inclusive and critically thinking aware as possible, and then to move through an experience and perceive as much as we can about the experience without labeling it good, bad, painful, happy. Just move through the whatever experience comes in the hopes that gradually, with focusing on an awareness, thinking about it, moving through it, what happens is that our focus becomes internal, that we become more aware of spirit as an entity experiencing something, and less attached, less enmeshed in whatever the experience and the conditions, the limiting conditions might be. In that process, where we experience something, we're aware of it, we try to discern what it means or what it's about, very gradually what happens is our interpretation becomes more and more neutral, less and less about suffering, and more about what is this, how can I refine my desire to live and express it, and what can I do with this new learning to serve someone else or to relieve the pain and suffering of the next individual. That process, probably at the beginning, sounds like a heck of a lot of pain and suffering. As we move through it, it actually becomes an incredible remedy and diffuses the pain and suffering, and literally we can transmute it or rise above it, however we want to try to envision that. Do we have to accept that as the path and the way to go? Are we charged with accepting as soul, I want to be the Christ or I want to be the Buddha. No, not at all. We're challenged in the pages of an ancient text, the Bhagavad Gita, to act as seems best to us, to live through a process, to be aware, discern as best we can, report to others literally, and compare with others, and then pick up those pieces and try something again. Yeah.
Well, sometimes we're confused. We know what we should do.
Often we're confused.
We know what we should do, but often we don't wish to. Or we have a great desire to do something, and we know we shouldn't do it. So we get confused on these two the qualities that exist in our nature until we understand who and what we truly are. There will always be that controversy, and the sad part about it is we get hurt when we do what we want rather than what we should.
The confusion of the duality. You know, desire on the one hand, will on the other. Spirit on the one hand, matter on the other. The permanent entity, the perceiver, the soul on the one hand, the personality and the physical on the other. The dichotomy can be confusing. But, you know, not all thoughts and not all currents of habit are actually ours to connect with. If we're living in the astral, you know, the earlier comment about animals sensing the astral and responding to the astral and what we put out in the way of energy into the astral, the talk mentioned collectivity or universality. Where we are in evolution, we appear to be separate spiritual entities. We appear to be unique personalities and unique bodies. But we move through incredible degrees of substance, seven upon seven upon 7 degrees of substance. And we frequently pick up from the astral, pick up from the force of ideation of all the souls in and around us, or perhaps around the world tuned into the same channel, so to speak. We pick up thoughts. We pick up the sense of a passion or a desire of a lower nature or a higher nature. And the confusion becomes in what the talk pointed out as the difference between the flash impulse that might flash in on us and startle us, and we may turn our focus and become totally distracted and focused on that passion of a lower nature, versus a sustained effort to turn our focus of mind, soul, heart, however you want to see that, and turn that on a sustained, universal, harmonic level of force and energy that may or may not be something that's radiating from the conditions around us. It's something that we choose, that we're aware of, and that we're generating on our own. Yeah.
To put it just slightly differently, it seems to me that desire is something that is spontaneous, maybe not voluntary, it's comes. And will is something that you can direct. You don't usually direct desire. You have a desire. You must evaluate the desire and see how whether and how you will turn it into action, like starting the car and stuff. So that the will is pushed by desire in some way, but the will, decision to go forward or which way to go. When making these considerations, it seems to me it's really important to consider not only myself and my own little universe, but how this desire fits into the picture of the whole, the one life, the unity, where we are all in it together. And I think that's really important.
Mm-hmm. Motive is probably the I'm going to say field of play, and probably there are better words to say that. But if all of these forces come forth from one source, all emanations of soul, all degrees of the ladder of the principles of being all come from one source, then that motive, that internal thought process by which we choose to act or not act, or the plane of ethical causation that we choose to use, certainly colors the use of force and will. And you know, there's actually very little in the documentation about will, because this is such a potent subject matter. There's, if this is the first of all powers, if Paracelsus said that will was the basis of all magic, then focus and one-pointedness and all these other aspects of mind, and the potent potentiality available to the human state, to soul and human state, is really incredible. The one source that you might turn to consider the comment that was just given is Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms. Somewhere around Roman numeral 13, 14, 15, there's consideration as to will. And Patanjali quotes the Hindus as saying that will is spiritual. It is a spiritual power, function, or attribute. It is constantly present throughout the entire universe. Desire moves will into action, and the task is to free will, free it from desire, so that will can dominate mind. And it's very interesting in Patanjali, that last statement, free will, doesn't say your will, my will, our will, the human will, it says free will from desire, again, no particularization of desire, so that will can dominate the mind. Yeah.
So now I'm more confused than when I came in, because that statement makes perfect sense to me. Will, to me, is a universal force to love, to life, to mm-hmm. want to exist. So it's undifferentiated.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas desires are what will manifest as. So will is always there. I don't think we have a choice to turn will on or off. If you exist in this plane, will is turned on, and will is the flow of energy. Mm-hmm. And desires determine what that will is going to manifest into. But what's difficult about that for me is that, according to that theory, all animals, all plants, all minerals would have will, because will is just the universal one force that wants to exist. So this mm-hmm. whole idea about humans having will and others don't doesn't make any sense to me.
Oh, free will. So will is, it's universal. Force of kama, desire, is universal. There is a colorless, without attribute, if you will, sense of karma as a force, isn't there? Cause and effect, periodicity. In the animal, in the vegetable, in the mineral, there is no potential. The conditions of that of those states are such that those states limit the degree of intelligence that can be expressed. And therefore, those states confine or contract so that the will that can be channeled, or the will, the desire, the universal forces, life, if you want to label it that universal, has a limited expression in those particular states. The universality exists. The lens through which it's passing, the channel through which it's passing, is conditioned or limited. In the human state, and we know that within the human sevenfold principles, just within the physical, we include in the physicality of these forms, mineral, vegetable, and animal, the conditionality is different. The lens is different. There's the potential for the thinker to open up that lens and open it and expand it, so, and identify with the spiritual sensing, the spiritual entity that is true permanence, and therefore allow more of the universality, more of that harmonic to flow through, or the mind of that particular entity, the mind being focused in that soul, can contract and constrict and condition the force in the field of will and desire, motive.
Well,
help me.
Conversely, will can be frozen by dogmatic and limiting ideas. It can, in a sense, the power is always there, the access is always there, if we can move beyond those limitations. And that has to do with self-knowledge, to really test, check, and verify everything, and to, you know, most of us were raised in some kind of religion, or we're all affected by it anyway, even if we weren't raised in any particular religion. But dogmas, they nail us in place, in a sense.
And let's expand the field of that. This is not straight line theosophical literature, but you can search on key terms like self-fulfilling prophecy, which is a psychological notion. You can search on the container theory, which is another psychological notion. Popularized ideas of very ancient truths that the belief system that you instill in a child about the nature of their existence and identity, that belief system can be instilled in the home by primary caregivers. It can be instilled by the neighborhood bully in the sandbox. It can be instilled in the classroom across many years of time. But the self-fulfilling prophecy, that notion is how I as a thinker define who and what I am, and the range of what I can do determines what I will do, what I can do, what I desire to do. It's a very complex knot, and certainly really important. The main thing is to be willing, to be open to the ideas. There's a hand way in the back corner.
I was thinking about the jumping statement before.
A little bit louder.
I was thinking before about the gentleman's statement about idealized notions of a highest spiritual entity, coming into terms with that. And I was wondering how one could become this form and sort of keep going through actions to stay within this form and still have the same reactions to empathy, because it seems like if you're a vessel through which suffering moves through and you're observing it without being attached to it, your reactions to empathy would be very different than had you been attached to that form of empathy.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like if you're in the state of utopia and others were there with you, how could there be suffering in utopia?
Utopia on, you know, the perfected place on this plane is limited by how we can imagine it and bring it into force. If it were devachanic, there would be no points of contrast, and that's a whole different level of study, and we're actually out of time. But certainly there are many people here that would love to talk with you about that, and the library would be open too. That as we change our potential, as we become more willing to be open and to be spiritual and to be universal, the suffering that we experience may be of a different degree. It may become suffering on behalf of the others that we see that are still befuddled. And our own existence will become richer and purer the more assistance we can be of others. Plants, animals, minerals, or man. Doesn't matter. Our time's up. See you Wednesday.